It's a great pleasure to have Bill Freeling here. I don't know, I think everybody knows Bill Freeling's reputation as one of the premier, preeminent historians of the pre-Civil War era. I'm not sure how many know that Bill's wife, Allison, is also an eminent historian of basically the same period. Her book, Drift Towards Dissolution, The Virginia Slavery Debate of 1831-1832, is a book that surprised and educated me when I first read it 10 or 15 years ago, and I have used it in teaching a survey course in Virginia history about how Virginia actually engaged in a serious debate about the abolition of slavery as early as 1831-1832. And one of the critical votes in the Virginia Senate actually was defeated by only one vote, as I remember. And a lot of people who think of Virginia in one light would be surprised by that book. And so I hope at some point we can entice Allison Freeling to come over here and talk as well as Bill. But today we are very happy to have Bill Freeling here. Bill was educated at Harvard and at the University of California at Berkeley. He has held professorships at Michigan State, at SUNY, at Johns Hopkins, and at the University of Kentucky. Now he is a senior and permanent fellow at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. He has published four books on the American Civil War or the pre-Civil War period, and of those four books, three of them have won major awards. His book, Prelude to Civil War, The Nullification Controversy in South Carolina, won two of the most prestigious awards, the Nevins and the Bancroft Prizes. I have used in teaching the American History Survey course his book, The Road to Disunion, Secessionists at Bay, 1774 to 1854. And his present scholarly production is on the second volume of that book, which will be out in March of next year. And I've already extracted a promise from Bill that he will come back and do a talk on that volume when it comes out. His other books, The South Versus the South, How the Anti-Confederate Southerners Compromised the Confederate War Effort in 2001, came out in 2001, and again is a terrific book on this period. I noticed Rob Vaughn, who directs the Virginia Foundation on the Humanities, is here, and Rob, perhaps during the question and answer discussion, we can get you to tell us a little bit about some of the other initiatives of the Virginia Foundation of the Humanities, in addition to supporting scholars like Bill Freeling. It is a great pleasure, and please join me in welcoming Bill Freeling.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and hello, everybody. And I look forward to talking to you about Abraham Lincoln today, except I must start by telling you that standing at this forum in this place, there is no excuse for my being here. The only person who should be here is Bill Miller, your own fellow, who is one of the great Lincoln scholars in the country. And it really moved me that Bill would ask me to appear at his forum today. And I accept only because it seems to me so fine that there should be a collaboration between the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and this wonderful institution. We both serve the same Charlottesville intellectual community. We both try to bring the humanities to the service of the general public, not just to fellow scholars. And I have tremendously enjoyed my friendship with Bill Miller and our collaboration on our two Lincoln projects. And I'm just very glad to be here at his forum, at his invitation, to once again make for a stronger collaboration between our two institutions. I'm just about to publish a book on the South and the coming of the Civil War that I've worked on for a long time, and I've started a project on Abraham Lincoln. And my project on Abraham Lincoln is based on his growth as president. I think he starts out making some very serious mistakes as president. I think he starts out not at all being a great president and ends up being a fabulous president. And I'm interested in that transition. And it seems to me a particularly important transition for this particular audience that is so interested in modern politics and in the modern presidency. Because I think that this story of Lincoln's growth in office gives us a barometer by which to judge our presidents over the last 50 years and to judge where they are succeeding and where they are not succeeding. So what better place to give my second public talk on Abraham Lincoln than to a forum that is interested in that crucial question, what does make for a great president? And I hope I can show you today that Lincoln helps us understand that and helps us understand the presidents of our own time. I only can talk about one piece of my book today, but I think it's one of the most interesting pieces. And it's on Lincoln's growth towards the 13th Amendment. Or I should say, Lincoln's growth away from his first two 13th Amendments. You all know about the final 13th Amendment. It freed the slaves and put into the Constitution a permanent way of freeing the slaves, whereas Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation 2 years earlier had only temporarily, possibly, and only until the war lasted, possibly, freed the slaves. Lincoln is very important in the final production of that final 13th Amendment. He twists some arms in Congress to get the necessary two-thirds vote in Congress to pass the amendment, and it's one of the final triumphs in office that he should achieve this 13th Amendment, forever freeing the slaves. And it is thus so startling, at least to me, and this is what started me on the whole project, to read his first 13th Amendment, which he first publicly proposed in his inaugural address of March 4th, 1861. And that constitutional amendment, that proposed 13th Amendment, which had already passed Congress and which Lincoln gave his blessings to on March 4th, 1861, declared that the Constitution should never be amended to allow the federal government to abolish slavery. Lincoln's first 13th Amendment declares that there shall be no constitutional amendment ever abolishing slavery. By the way, it's perfectly constitutional to do that because the Constitution, in its very amending clause, says that no state shall lose its capacity to have two senators by a constitutional amendment unless that state agrees to be defrauded of its two senators. So in the Constitution itself, there is a provision for an unamendable level of the Constitution. And that first 13th Amendment seems to me a bookend around Lincoln's presidency, forever stopping the federal government from abolishing slavery, contrasting so amazingly with the final 13th Amendment, forever abolishing slavery, and as we'll see right in the middle, there's still a more startling Lincoln proposal for a 13th Amendment. The first question I think you have to ask, the thing that got me started in this whole book, is how in the world could Abraham Lincoln have ever agreed to such a 13th Amendment? How could the great emancipator ever have proposed a constitutional amendment forever stopping him from being a great emancipator? Forever stopping the federal government from abolishing slavery. There are several good answers to this, but my own favorite answer has come to be that Lincoln did not think he needed the federal government to abolish slavery in the South. That Lincoln thought he could persuade the various constituencies necessary to abolish slavery in the South, and thus that there would never be a forcible need for the federal government to force on the South an amendment abolishing slavery. That is to say, Lincoln preferred to govern by persuasion, by convincing people, not by coercion, not by forcing social reforms on a constituency. Now, right here, you can see how valuable my friendship with Bill Miller has been. Because the minute I said this to Bill, he said, come on, come on, come on. Lincoln obviously believes in coercion. What do you think, Mr. Freeling, that the whole Civil War is about? And indeed, the Civil War is about the coercive insistence that the South obeys the law. But I think there is a difference between a coercive insistence that a constituency obeys the law and a coercive law that forces an institution to change. Lincoln does think that after a majority has decided on a policy, that the minority must acquiesce in that policy. And he will not allow the South to secede. And he will use coercion to force acceptance of a law. But when it comes to what law should be passed, and how you should reform a country, Lincoln, I think, does not want to force anything on anybody. He doesn't think the Union can last that way. He doesn't think that the best way to reform a country is to force your own ideas on a people. What you try to do is persuade them. I believe that Lincoln's concept of persuasion comes profoundly from the fact that he was a very great lawyer before he was any kind of president. One of America's greatest lawyers. And what lawyers do, as we all know, is plead. They plead their case before a jury. They plead their case before the opposing attorney. They try to convince. And Lincoln was a perfectly marvelous persuader. And extremely adept at the art of using language to convince people. It's what he was trained to do. It's the way he came to power through his oratory in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and in his oratory, his persuasive power at the Cooper's Union speech in New York. And he had great faith in his ability to persuade people. And I believe during the Civil War, he had great faith that he could persuade the various constituencies in the South that slavery should be abolished. So there would never be a need for a constitutional amendment forcing emancipation on the South. He would, on the contrary, persuade people that his worldview was right. And here's the second shocker about Lincoln. His ideal America, the America he most wanted to achieve, would liberate slaves, and I can't emphasize enough that Lincoln always hoped that slaves would be freed, always thought slavery was an abomination, or at least always did after the early 1850s, never deviated from calling slavery an evil that he wished to get rid of. But the shocker is that he also wishes to get rid of blacks. The shocker is that he does not wish to integrate blacks into American society. The shocker is that he is an advocate of a lily-white America where blacks will not only be freed, but sent over to Africa. That is to say, he's a colonizationist. As I believe practically every important American politician is a colonizationist. From the time of Jefferson to the time of Washington. There are a lot of Lincoln scholars who poo-poo this, who say that don't emphasize that very much because Lincoln wasn't as vicious on this subject as some other people were. But that, I think, is to miss the meaning of Lincoln's life, which is that he held a worldview that most Americans did, and he tried to achieve it. And when he couldn't achieve it, he moved on to something else. He did not think that blacks and whites could ever live peacefully together in America. He did not think that blacks could ever be equally integrated into American society. He did not think that you should ever make voters or jurors of Negroes, and he makes that very clear in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And so he thinks that for blacks, America is a hopeless place. And the best thing for blacks and the best thing for America is if blacks leave and if blacks are colonized. Now, the first thing people say to me when I say that Lincoln believed in colonization, and so does Madison, and so does Jefferson, and so does Washington, and so does practically any American statesman you can think of, except maybe the Adamses, during this whole period, the first thing things say is, how could anybody believe in something as impractical as sending all blacks back to Africa? But with one exception, I don't think it was impractical. It was not impractical to find the ships to do that if you wished to do that. After all, this is an age when millions and millions of Europeans sailed from Europe to America. It is also an age when hundreds of thousands of Indians are removed from the white habitat. In terms of the economic feasibility of doing this, it could be done. There was only one real problem with achieving colonization, and that is, to their very great credit, not Jefferson, not Lincoln, none of these colonizationists thought that you could force blacks to leave. None of them thought you could deport back blacks coercively. All of them believed that blacks had to agree to go back to Africa or wherever you wished to colonize them. And without that black agreement, it couldn't be done. And that's the sticking point. That's what Lincoln has to overcome. It's not that he can't afford it. The country can afford it. It's that he's got to get by the fact that blacks have to be persuaded to go. And Lincoln is very much addicted to his own gift of persuasion, and he thinks he can persuade blacks to go. And if he can persuade blacks to go, he thinks he can also persuade whites to let them go. That is to say, he thinks that the Southerners can be persuaded to abolish slavery. And his notion is, if the federal government can offer funds to colonize the blacks, funds to compensate slaveholders for leaving, eventually the white Southerners will agree to the situation. So you really don't need something like a 13th Amendment. You can agree that the federal government shall never abolish slavery because you can persuade the various parts of your constituency to accept Lincoln's view of the world. Probably the most important particular thing Lincoln must do is to persuade the blacks to go. And it's that causes what I think is a key moment, not only in Lincoln's presidency, but in American history. In 1862, Lincoln issues the first invitation ever by a president for blacks to come to the White House and confer with him. And a bunch of black leaders come to the White House, and they come intending to persuade Lincoln to let him in their army, to let him in his army. It's the goal of the blacks at this point to get into the Union Army, to help defeat the slaveholders, and by doing that, to help persuade the country that blacks should be free. Lincoln is refusing to allow them into the army at this point. He doesn't wish to do anything unnecessary to have the rebels fight even harder, and he is refusing to let blacks in the army, despite growing pressure around him to do exactly that. So they come to the White House, and they come hoping to persuade Lincoln that he can to let them into his army. And he looks them squarely in the eye and says, no, what I must do is persuade you to leave America. And the blacks look at him and they're sort of stunned. And they say, in effect, we don't want to do that. We're leaders of the blacks in America. This is our country, Mr. President, too. And he whirls on them and says, you are taking a most selfish view of the matter. Now that strikes me as the nadir of Lincoln's presidency. And every time I say that, my pal Bill Miller says, come on, come on, come on, try to use some other word. But it does strike me as the nadir of Lincoln's presidency. But much more than that, it strikes me as the nadir, a nadir of American history in the middle of the 19th century. Because that could happen with any of these presidents. They all believed that blacks were being selfish in deciding to stay. They all believed that it would be wonderful if blacks left. So what we have here is not the low point of Lincoln's presidency, but I think a low point in American history, and a very dramatic low point at this first moment that blacks come into the White House. So the blacks can't be persuaded to leave. And Lincoln can't persuade the whites either that his view of America should be accomplished. First of all, he thinks he can persuade the secessionists to come back into the Union if they will see that he does not want to abolish slavery unless they agree to abolish slavery, but they won't come back. They won't, as Lincoln says, sees it, see reason. They keep fighting, and they keep fighting very successfully in 1862. Lincoln also thinks that he can persuade the border South, which is still staying in the Union and is still a slaveholding part of the nation, Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, and Kentucky, all part of the Union, all still owning slaves, and Lincoln thinks he can persuade them to abolish slavery, particularly if he continually offers them, as he does, packages which will compensate them for allowing their slaves to be abolished, and their slaves to be transported to Africa. He's marshaling the full funds of the federal government to do this. By the way, during his presidency, the Congress passes $600,000 worth of funds to colonize blacks in Africa at Lincoln's request. None of his persuasive tactics are working in 1862, and meanwhile, his various attempts to stop coercive federal emancipation are growing more and more unpopular. Lincoln, continually in his first 2 years of the office, stops various federal modes of colonization. A couple of his generals issue emancipation proclamations, freeing the slaves in their area. Lincoln turns them down. His Secretary of War wishes to invite blacks into the Union Army. Lincoln turns them down. He continually turns down these efforts to coercively try to abolish slavery, with the federal government forcing abolition on anybody in favor of trying to persuade people to abolish slavery. But it's not working. Nobody's being persuaded. The war is not being won. Blacks are running away from their masters and knocking on the door, trying to get in Lincoln's army, and Lincoln is beginning to worry that he doesn't have enough troops, and here is a gold mine of possible troops that want into the army. Meanwhile, there are all kinds of Republicans in his own party who are trying to press Lincoln to stop this foolishness of trying to defeat the rebels and not taking away the rebels' property and not using the rebels' property against the rebels in the Union Army. So Lincoln's coming under great pressure to change his mind. And the result, I think, is the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation of September 1862, which promises to issue a final Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, if the war is not won. When you read many accounts of Lincoln's presidency, this is the pivotal moment. When he issues the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, promising that he will issue a proclamation in some 90 days freeing the slaves. And then it is a major step forward for Lincoln. And he does say in the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation that he will accept black manual laborers into his army. Not black soldiers, but black military laborers into his army, which is another step towards emancipation. But it is, I think, false to think that Lincoln has given up on his own program. And he, in various ways, continues to try to persuade Southerners and blacks to fulfill his lily-white version of the American dream. And the most important moment in that, and I think an equally stunning moment to that first constitutional amendment that Lincoln proposes, is the second 13th Amendment that he proposes in his annual message of December 1st, 1862. In that annual message, Lincoln says, and I'm going to issue this Emancipation Proclamation in 30 days, in 31 days, but meanwhile I want to propose an alternate plan. And I want to propose a constitutional amendment that for the federal government issue bonds to pay for emancipation of any slave whose owner agrees to be freed, and to pay for the colonization of blacks. And with that constitutional amendment, I think we can settle this whole issue. And there's a clause in that proposal by Lincoln which always really gets me. And if Bill Miller will excuse me, I'll tell this audience about it. And that clause is that after any state has abolished slavery, and after we have paid you to do that, if you should later want to change your mind, you must give the money back. If you should later want to reinstitute slavery, all right. But you must pay me my money back, says the man who's about to issue the final Emancipation Proclamation in 30 days. And I've always also been struck by the incredible language Lincoln uses in that, if I can find my glasses. Here we go. You should never get up to speak unless your glasses are available. Now, he's just proposed that we buy out everybody. We persuade blacks to go with colonization money. We persuade the South to quit fighting with a promise that we'll pay them for all their slaves. In short, we will persuade everybody so I don't have to issue that Emancipation Proclamation in 30 days. And then he says, fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We, even here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. In giving freedom to the slaves, we assure freedom to the free. Honorable alike in what we give and what we preserve, we shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope on earth. Other means may succeed that could not, but this could not fail. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just, a way if followed, the world will forever applaud and God will forever bless, says Mr. Lincoln in his most gorgeous language, trying to persuade the country to avoid the Emancipation Proclamation 30 days before the Emancipation Proclamation is issued. He's got no takers. Nobody is persuaded. He realizes at this point he has made his best effort to accomplish all this by persuasion. And he realizes he's got to change. And on January 1st, 1863, we have a very new, I think, President Lincoln. There are precedents for this new Lincoln in the past, particularly in certain clauses of the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. But there is now no doubt that Lincoln insists that freedom, coercively achieved by the federal government, is his war aim, and that this war will not stop until the Emancipation Proclamation is accepted. And his proclamation frees all slaves in any future area the federal government shall conquer, and announces that freedom will come to the country by the edict of the federal government. I'm really impressed by how quickly and how decisively Lincoln enforces that coercive kind of emancipation that he has at last turned to. I think he's scared to death that this won't work, scared to death that this will alienate the border South, alienate the Southern Democrats, alienate all the people who've tried to help him hold back on emancipation. And he's got to have it work. And the only way he can have it work is to have the blacks mass to his support. And he, in various ways, develops bureaucratic means to appeal to the blacks, to persuade them, if you will, this time to run away from their masters and to join the Union Army. And he has fantastic success. By the end of the war, 150,000 blacks are in the Union Army. 100,000 of them run away from their slaves. This mode of persuasion has worked. And Lincoln is absolutely delighted by that fact. And it leads to a new White House and a new vision of America. In that new White House, blacks like Frederick Douglass are very welcome. Welcome not to be persuaded to go to Africa, but welcome to be persuaded to have their, for them to persuade other blacks to race toward freedom and join the Union Army. There's a congenial atmosphere for blacks now in the White House. And we have Frederick Douglass saying that he never felt more at home in any house than he felt in Lincoln's house in 1863 and 64. How different that is from the conference he had in 1862 with those people who were being very selfish by refusing to leave America. And there is an entirely different vision of America that Lincoln has, and I'm so impressed by this. He never again utters the word colonization. He never again seeks to persuade anybody that the solution for America is for blacks to leave. He fully accepts the notion of an America which will be inclusive, which will always have blacks and whites living together, and which will never try to send away blacks and make America just a nation for Anglo-Saxons. And in his final, and I think most moving moment of all, when the temporary governor of Louisiana writes him and asks what conditions of Reconstruction he would recommend, Lincoln says, "I recommend to you that the most educated blacks, and particularly the ones that serve in the Army, should become voters." Now, we have to be careful about praising Lincoln too much for that. He is obviously talking about only a few blacks being voters. He is not saying, "I coercively insist that this is the only way you'll get back into the Union." He is again trying to persuade the governor to allow blacks not only to be freedmen, not only to be part of the Army, but to be voters, exactly what he denied before. And this, I think, contrasts so much with the first Lincoln. And then, as you all know, he insists that Congress pass a 13th Amendment extending freedom to all blacks, and he truly becomes a great emancipator wherever he started. So you have this transition of this man who believes in a lily-white America and thinks he can persuade people to achieve it, to, at the beginning of the war, to, in the middle of the war, this man issuing this 13th Amendment trying to purchase freedom for the blacks, again, voluntarily, with the notion that if they change their mind, they've got to return the money, to this final Lincoln, who is in favor of coercively freeing the slaves. And this growth of Lincoln seems to me a very, very interesting phenomenon. And it's also, of course, a growth of America itself, of a nation coming somewhat to terms with blacks and trying somewhat to achieve some kind of freedom and a smidgen of equality past freedom for blacks. Obviously, the nation is not there. The tragedies of Reconstruction, the tragedies of our own time show that. But you can see this movement forward in the Lincoln presidency. Now, how does all of this help us evaluate our present leaders? It seems to me that what Lincoln shows is two things that any great president must have. First of all, any great president must have growth. Any great president must be able to see when his policies are not working. Any great president must be able to see that that failures do not necessarily generate sticking the course, but failures generate the kind of flexibility which will allow you to change course in order to achieve your objective. That's what Lincoln does so spectacularly during the Civil War. And at least in my judgment, I don't know what you guys think, you can tell me in the question and answer period, I don't think our recent presidents have been so good at that capacity to reevaluate a situation and change their minds. And secondly, I think any great American president has got to try to move towards a more inclusive America, an America that is not just for Anglo-Saxons, that is not just for the original Americans, but is also an America that welcomes other people of other races, sexes, and genders into the mainstream. If you have a president who's flexible enough to grow, and a president who in some ways at least moves towards greater inclusion of other people in America, I think you can begin to have a great president. And I think the growth of Abraham Lincoln demonstrates that as few other events do in our history. And I thank you so much for your wonderful attention.
We are blessed today to have two other eminent historians of this period, Michael Holt, who has written extensively about the 1850s and the run-up to the Civil War, and Bill Miller, who is one of the leading Lincoln scholars in the country. And I'm going to ask them to start the conversation, but while they're framing their comments and questions, let me ask Rob Vaughn, who directs the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, if he would give this audience, not all of whose members may be familiar with the foundation, if you would just give us maybe a two-minute overview of the work of the foundation.
Well, thanks. Appreciate it. I know a lot of people in this room. There are a lot of friends of both organizations. Do you want me up front?
Sure.
Do I need a microphone?
Come stand here and look at a picture of Lincoln.
Thank you, George. I appreciate the opportunity. And I find it almost impossible to keep anything about the Virginia Foundation to 2 minutes. That's tough. I find it really interesting, and I didn't even think about this until I was suddenly sitting there, and George said, come up here and say something, that the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which still carries in its name and public policy, though we don't use it, and the Miller Center of Public Affairs were founded in the same year in the same building, which no longer exists at the university. It was called Miller Hall, and it was where the Harrison Center is now located. But that same year, both organizations are still going pretty strong at this point. The Virginia Foundation is the largest humanities program, the most diverse in its programming and funding and entrepreneurial activities in the United States. And it is one of the three or four largest humanities centers of any kind in the United States at this point. We have a special interest in programs in reading, books, and literacy. And I think probably everybody in this audience knows the Virginia Festival of the Book, which we created 13 years ago, and we're about to go into our 13th season. We still produce it in-house. We also have a lot of literacy programs as well. We have a long-time interest in media, and we produce in-house the With Good Reason radio program, which I hope you hear, and if you don't, I hope you will find it. Weekly program looking at what's going on in Virginia's colleges and universities. We also produce a Humanities Features Bureau, which is carried during the morning drive time, evening drive time on NPR. We have film production studios as well. Most recently produced a film called Reimagining Ireland, which was shown throughout the United States on PBS and in Ireland on RTE television and in other parts of the world as well. So those facilities are there in-house for us. We do have a fellowship program, and I'm delighted that Bill is representing us here. We would send him out anywhere at any time, and I'm delighted that he will go. We also make grants, about 80 a year, that, unlike fellowships which support individuals, support institutions for programming. And we support some activities at the University of Virginia, Piedmont, Monticello, Ashland, Focus Resource Center. We started the Ashland Opera Festival 28 years ago now, with the initial support for that as well. And we have a special interest in minority cultures and minority peoples, programs in African-American heritage in Virginia, Virginia Indian heritage, women's studies. The Women's Cultural History Project remains one of our largest efforts to date. And among new activities, we are undertaking the development of an online Virginia encyclopedia, which we will premiere sometime next year. We're vague about exactly which month this is going to come out because we're now just getting underway in building the architecture for this site. There is no history. There is no historical atlas. There's no encyclopedia, no complete reference work on the history of Virginia ever. This will be a digital project that anybody can access for free from anywhere in the world for any purpose, to learn about the history, culture, arts, recreation, sports, geography, science, biography of Virginia. It's going to take about 5 years to build it, but stay tuned, maybe July, maybe September of next year, when we will go live with the initial part that's focusing on the settlement, the 1607 settlement of Virginia, and the prehistory of that settlement and the post-history there as well. So those are just a few of the kinds of activities that we undertake. Take a look at virginiafoundation.org. We've got about 25 different programs that we have sustained now for about 32 years. And we're always looking for new individuals and new support, new people to be involved in what we do as well. So thank you, George. I appreciate it.
Professor Holt or Professor Miller, would either of you like to start the conversation? Mike Holt, I've never known you to be reticent.
Well, Bill and I have talked about this on a number of previous occasions, and so what I'm going to say is not new, but I, to him. I wonder if your portrait of such a dramatic turning point on January 1st, 1863, is really that accurate. Let me just point out two contrary things that that suggest that there was a more gradual evolution. As you know, on July 17th, 1862, Congress passed both the Militia Act and a second confiscation act, both of which required the Union Army to accept runaway slaves and declare them free on reaching Union Army lines. This was a congressional attempt at emancipation, and Lincoln endorsed this in the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation of September 22nd. So a sort of finality of emancipation preceded, in some ways, January 1st. On the other hand, you used to be struck by how he tried to get these commanders to hold congressional elections so areas could be exempted from emancipation after the pandemic. But what you call the his second 13th Amendment, he did not give up, I don't think, on the idea of compensation to slaveholders. He raised it again at the Hampton Roads Peace Conference, and members of his cabinet who weren't there were just furious with him when he came back to Washington. So that I wonder if you might want to temper your argument about how decisive January 1 was.
Well, you can see why Mike Holt is one of the nation's best historians, and I stand corrected. I'm not trying to say that the on one day everything happened, because there are all kinds of precedents. And by the way, one of the precedents is the pressure that Congress is putting on Lincoln with laws like that 1862 laws. And there is lingering efforts at compensation. That's right. History doesn't stop on a dime. And if I implied that today, I'm sorry. But I do think that that January 1st event is a major event. And I do think that Lincoln himself thought so. And Lincoln himself was determined that from then on, that would be the law, and the Emancipation Proclamation would not be backed off from. If I could take 30 more seconds, this determination to stick by what he said on January 1st, 1863, is one of the things that I think is most sharply evident about Lincoln. And I'm reminded very much, as I've told him, by Bill Miller's wonderful first chapter in his new book on the oath. Miller argues that a man who has taken a constitutional oath, like Lincoln does in his inaugural address, that changes everything for him. And I think a man who has made an oath to the blacks that he will free them if they will join his army is acting the same way, with that same kind of integrity. It would be monstrous of me to disobey my oath to the blacks on January 1st, 1863. So I'm sorry if I implied that everything happened on that one day, but I do think that was the major turning point. Insofar as any historical event can have major turning points, with all its antecedents before and all its lingering remnants after. And the Lincoln was very determined that it would be the decisive moment of his presidency and the moment the war turned, and he was right.
Professor Miller?
Well, I'm embarrassed by all these extravagant references to me, and I don't want to say anything that would disillusion anybody who would go so far as to believe them. And I think it was a terrific talk. Dramatic, powerful, impressive. I learned things. And I entirely agree with the second half of it. What I think, what Mike said, July Lincoln lets out that he's going to issue an Emancipation Proclamation in the summer, before the August meeting with the black visitors. But I'm going to figure out, the other thing, I guess, whether the first 13th Amendment can really be called Lincoln's. I think Bill, and maybe Bill and Mike, can persuade me of that. But in the inaugural address, it's an insert in which he acquiesces in what has already been done. He specifically says it doesn't add anything to what the Constitution is already, and okay if they want to do it. It's not as though it is an initiative of his own. I entirely agree that the nadir, I pick up the word from Bill Freeling, and specifically said that sentence about it would be selfish of you not to accept. I agree with that. So I think it was a terrific talk, and I learned from it.
Thank you, Professor Miller. Who would like to continue the conversation? Peyton Weary?
Do you see any lessons here as we wrestle with this problem of immigration that might help us as we deal with this issue?
Well, as I'm sure you could tell from my implications, I do think that any time we can make America more inclusive, any time we can include women in American life at the top levels, any time we can include blacks in American life, and any time we can include those people who are temporarily here in America, it is a step forward. And I think that's what Lincoln had in mind. And I do think that George Bush, whatever you want to say about him on other matters, and I have a lot to say about him on other matters, is right on this one. Just as I think Lyndon Johnson, whatever you want to say about him on other matters, was everlastingly right about civil rights. It does seem to me that our modern presidents have picked up that second lesson that Lincoln has to teach better than that first lesson about flexibility. But I'm sure there are people here who disagree with me about that.
On the subject of colonization, what administration was instrumental in setting up Liberia and that project?
Well, it isn't actually, that's a very good question. Thank you for it. It isn't actually the federal government that sets up that project. It's the American Colonization Society, a private philanthropic organization that sets up the colony of Liberia, and it occurs in about 1821. And this is the first time under Lincoln's presidency that the federal government has ever, so far as I know, put a massive amount of funds into that project. But the reason I'm so glad you asked that question is it enables me to make a point that I cannot make enough because people just don't believe it. And that is that American colonization, that whole dream of sending sending blacks back to America, back to Africa, is as American as apple pie. There is just massive support for that notion among whites. The American Colonization Society is the most wealthy philanthropic organization in America in the middle of the 19th century. It has more members than any other organization. It is a conviction of millions and millions of Americans at the highest level that this nation would be better off if blacks would be sent to Africa. And that those people are not just being cynical. They are convinced that blacks would be better off if they went to Africa. They are convinced, as Lincoln and Jefferson were, that blacks will never have an equal opportunity in America. And it's this combination of crass racism and a degree of idealism that we find disgusting that makes that notion so popular. So no, the federal government is not involved, but the American Colonization Society is, and that too shows you how strong this impulse is in America and how we must not dismiss it if we would understand our country.
Professor Matthew Holden.
On the colonization subject, I understand the foundation you have laid in this talk. But since you have chosen to refer to members of the early generation as evidence, let me ask a question in two parts. Part one is, if you choose the Washington-Jefferson illustration, what would you say on that subject of Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, Rufus King? I could go a little beyond that, on that subject. Secondly, on the colonization subject, I've recently gone through for other purposes, in some detail, the congressional debates leading up to the decision that became the Missouri Compromise. And there's extensive debate in the House And on the losing side, there is considerable advocacy of the proposition of maintaining the citizenship rights of the existing free blacks. But I did not find on that side the colonization subject appearing very substantially at all. If I did not misread, how would you reconcile that with the emphasis you've given it?
Well, that is really fascinating. And I do hope that your research will be blessed and that you will write the book that couldn't
be published.
Because the point you're making is a very good one, which is that this is not a black and white subject. There certainly are important white Americans who want no part of this colonization thing. And the country is not altogether convinced by colonization. It's perfectly possible that that even a majority might vote against it in a free election. I didn't mean to imply that this is just a black and white subject, but I did mean to imply, and I would insist, that the colonization option is considered a live one by people like Jefferson, a live one by people like Lincoln, and even in the black community in the 1850s is considered a live option, because many blacks like Garnett and Delaney are rather convinced that they're not going to be able to make it in America. What I want to see is not historians say, oh, all Americans favored colonization, but to recognize that that is an option which is alive and well in the 19th century. And once we understand that, we're in a better, we're better able to see the complications, the racial complications of our history.
Dr. Cooper?
In my strictly amateur reading of the period, biographies of Lincoln and discussions of his presidency, there is always mention of colonization, but it's brief and superficial. Do you think that historians have really dropped the ball on this topic? And are there some reasons why it's being downplayed? Is it is there a Northern influence in telling the story of Lincoln? Is there some need to downplay the concept of colonization as something that Lincoln actually talked about and others talked about?
What a splendid question, Professor Cooper. Thank you very much. And I often think about that because I'm so aware of what you're talking about, that most Americans and most American historians don't want to believe what I've said. They don't want to believe that there is another side to Lincoln. They don't want to believe there's an earlier side to Lincoln. They want to downplay that earlier side. I think they're doing Lincoln a disservice by doing that. I think you understand Lincoln's greatness even more when you realize what he overcame. I think you understand even more what a creative thinker this was when you realize where he begun. So I don't think they're doing Lincoln any favors. And I want to emphasize when I write this book that this is not a Lincoln bashing book that I'm writing. This is a book that takes a man of very great complexity and looks at where he started and where he ended, and where he started throws a lot of light on where he ended. But I do think it's a bad defect of Americans and of their historians to think that Lincoln is some perfect being, that he cannot find anything wrong. If you wouldn't mind my saying this, this is one reason I have reservations about Doris Kearns' book, because she doesn't see the difficulties in the beginning between Lincoln and Seward in talking about their alliances. I think, need to see our people whole, and need to see all sides of them, and don't need to apologize for what they did and what they stood for, but understand it and watch them, if they can, move beyond the poor beginnings. I think the best answer I can give to your question is I think people are going to see this as anti-Lincoln, what I'm doing. And that's how sacrosanct that man is in our literature. And I don't think it is anti-Lincoln. Thank you, Dr. Cooper. I just love your question. I stew about it every night. I don't want to be lynched, you see.
Penny Holt.
Thank you for an interesting talk. I'm wondering, for what reason do you suppose that Lincoln changed? In other words, it may not have been as dramatic as we might suppose. It may have been gradual, but why did he? I mean, what did he always feel strongly, but as you said, wanted to persuade people to change their minds? Or did he really change his mind that much, and why did he come around to this new thinking?
What a great question, Mrs. Holt. We held a whole afternoon session with the best minds in Charlottesville at the foundation 6 months ago, trying to educate me on that subject, because I think it's the big subject. I think it's fairly easy to show that Lincoln changed, but why? Or to ask the question differently, what gave this man a capacity to change that other human beings don't seem to have? What is the source of human growth? Why is it that some of us can adjust to what happens to us and move on and get better for it, and a lot of people can't and keep making the same mistakes again? And I'm still wrestling with that. But here are some of my answers, and one of them actually comes from Mr. Miller. First of all, I think that this is a man who has spent a lifetime improving himself. He's a self-made man. He has educated himself, and he never seems to be satisfied with what he knows. The best example I know of is right in the middle of his career as one of the most successful lawyers in Illinois, not yet a successful politician, he stops and studies Euclid's geometry because he thinks he ought to know that. And this is a man who isn't satisfied with what he knows, who is always looking to know something more. What is it that makes a person like that? What is it that makes some of my students more curious than others of my students? What is it that makes some of your children better able to change than other of your children when they meet life's adversities? I don't really know the answers to that. I suppose I can't really write this book until I can answer it, but you can see what a good question it is. Do you have a good answer, by the way? putting it in more general terms, what do you think causes some people to be able to grow and other people not? Because that's the more general question I'm constantly wrestling with.
Frank Featherston has an answer.
I think we shouldn't forget that there's a war being fought all this time. Second Battle of Bull Run, Battle of Fredericksburg, Sharpsburg. So those shocks may have had something to do with how Mr. Lincoln was being conjured to make these changes.
Now that's very good, and I think there's a lot to that. The stakes are higher for Lincoln to change than a lot of presidents. I'm going to try to show this in other chapters in my book. I think he's partly responsible for the start of the war, and feels that he's partly responsible. As my friend Gary Gallagher puts it, and I know he's talked to you too, Lincoln had buckets of blood on his hands. Not blood on his hands, but buckets of blood on his hands. He had to win this war. He was afraid he was not winning it militarily. And that puts enormous pressure on a man to reconsider his propositions, which the answer Mrs. Holt would be, the answer would be, it's the situation he faces, the necessity he faces that forces him to change, whether the change is a fast one or a slow one. That's very good, thank you.
In Bob Gibson's column in the Daily Progress this past Sunday, he issued a plea for the revival of polite civil discourse on contentious issues. I wish that Bob had been here today, not only to hear Bill Freeling, but to hear Matthew Holden and Mike Holt and Bill Miller and all the rest of you who've offered terrific
insights into the issues that Bill Freeling raises. For your participation, and especially for Bill Freeling's contributions, we're very grateful. Thank you, Bill.